Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, our journey is with a PhD that almost got stuck at ABD. That's that all but dissertation. It happens. You get the undergrad, then you're off to grad school where you get your master's, but you end up with the master's because you've taken all the master's and doctorate classes, and at some point, you just want to feel like you've accomplished something. Then you have a family, and that dissertation, well, it gets set aside. Lucky for Sean Dubrovic, his university was providing him with gentle reminders of the goal at hand.
And so I took that letter and I hung that above my desk. That was my motivation. I felt like it would be a waste to not finish it. Now, in economics, we teach to ignore sunk costs. And so I really should have recognized that all the courses and work I put in were sunk costs and not to factor that in. But I think did factor that in and really wanted to finish.
And he did. It's a PhD in economics. But don't worry, it's more than that whole science dealing with the production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services or the material welfare of humankind studying. Today we're bringing technology into this economics equation, and we're talking about the economics of digitization.
Today, businesses are, for the most part, not prepared for the digital transformation that lays before them. They don't understand the tenets of digitization. They don't understand the properties and characteristics of digitization. And so they don't fully grasp how these changes will impact them.
Piling it high and deep with an economist asking big questions about the impact of technology and how businesses can learn to, better use it. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. Check out some other podcasts at themountaingeek.net or via Twitter at PhD the podcast. I'm also on Twitter at The Mountain Geek. This is a fun conversation. Enjoyed it. Sean's a great guest, and I want to thank him for taking the time out to talk with me. Also, thanks to the folks at Zencastr for making it possible to do this remotely. Sean's got an interesting story. It takes you from being an army brat to Utah, even spent some time in Europe. But we're talking technology and consumer electronics. Let's start shoveling. Where did your fascination with becoming a PhD begin?
So I think growing up, there was always a strong emphasis on education in my house. We had, multiple sets of encyclopedias. And so our battle against fake news when I was a young boy growing up was to check one set of encyclopedias and then check another set of encyclopedias. We grew up, sitting around the television watching Jeopardy as a family and buzzing in and trying to answer questions. And so education was always a very strong emphasis in my home growing up. And I have two older brothers who helped lead the way. One of them has an MBA from a top tier program, and another one has a PhD and teaches at the University of Kentucky. So there was always a very strong emphasis on education.
What were the parentals doing?
My dad was in the military and had served in the military for 26 years as an army officer. And my mother was at home with us.
Where was growing up?
So, growing up as part of an army family is growing up where the army sends you. And so I was born in Georgia, but lived there for a while, lived in Germany, Kansas, Texas, Virginia, and had the chance to see kind of everything in between those. And then later in my adult life, continued that odyssey, if you will, having spent time in California, Hawaii, Europe, the Middle East, and now here in Washington, D.C.
And what do you do in Washington?
So I spent 12 plus years as the chief economist for the Consumer Technology Association. Earlier in 2017, I left that job and started a research firm called Astra Insights that I now oversee.
Just you and the dog in the home office?
Pretty much. I'm on the road a little bit with that, and then am currently working from home. working out of the home. In addition to that, I also have gone back into teaching. Earlier in my career, had taught finance classes at both George Washington University in their MBA program and at George Mason University in their MBA program. One of the things I wanted to do was get back into academia a little bit, and so I'm back to teaching currently at Marymount University, and in the near future we'll be adding a class at American University.
So you're playing the role of instructor right now?
Correct. Yep. And it's great to be back in the classroom. I love being on a college campus. I love being challenged by a large group of students that they collectively have a lot of diverse experiences and a lot of knowledge, and I think that's a very good dialogue that we should seek to replicate in other places.
Do you see a difference in maybe how you're teaching coming from the quote real world or the business world compared to maybe a professor or an instructor that's been maybe just living in the silo of an academic life?
I certainly see where the skill sets that they could develop in the classroom and in the class that I'm teaching could easily translate into the professional world. I see the type of skill sets that would be useful to gain for them. I think it's tough as a student because you can't always make those connections. So even though I stress the connections, it's not always clear to me that they're internalizing those. The class I'm teaching is a economics class right now. It's focused on contemporary macroeconomic topics, and it's an intensive writing course. And this is something that's developed over the last few years, where as part of undergrad programs, they're designating certain classes as intensive writing courses. And so they have to do more writing than they would for other classes. I think it's a good shift. I think that's a skill set that's important to gain at the undergrad level. And I can see where the value can be applied in the real life. I don't know that they always see that. I think they still see the assignments I give as simply that, assignments, and the end goal is to do well, to get a good grade on the class, and then to move on. But certainly I can see the importance of some of the skill sets. And then when I've taught MBA classes, I always try to bring in practitioners and have them talk to the students. It isn't uncommon teaching a finance class at the MBA level and asking the students, what do you want to do when you graduate? And they'll often say something like, well, I want to work in finance. And then when I press them and say, well, what exactly and specifically do you want to do in finance? They just look back at me with an unsure look. And I think to have worked in the private sector, you recognize the importance of that question. You take a look at some of the Wall Street firms, and they've got hundreds of thousands of employees that do drastically different things. And some of them obviously will never interact with their peers in other groups. But students see the allure of a job on Wall Street or the allure of a job with a tech company. They see it as a means to an end, an opportunity to do well financially, to buy a nice car, to have a good home. But they don't recognize that the skill sets needed are drastically different. The type of work that they're doing is drastically different across different jobs within the same company. And I think that's an area that we're moving more towards. We're moving towards specialization as we automate routine tasks. The requirements of jobs become much more specialized, and so I think those pressures will only be mounting as we continue to press forward. So I try to bring in practitioners where I can to even just do a simple open panel where they can talk about the type of things that they do in a normal day and help the students gain some context around what their life might look like, what their jobs might look like.
I'm oftentimes one of those outside resources that gets called in to do those talks. This is more on the risk management and insurance side, but my background is insurance claims. I'm a former large loss claims adjuster. Now I do the consulting side, the advocacy side of insurance, of property insurance claims, working for an insurance broker. And oftentimes when I'm in front of students and they're asking, you know, what's the thing that I can do to be successful? And you know, those are kids that want to work in the insurance industry. I tell them the most important three things that you can probably do are make sure you can communicate well, both written and verbally. Make sure you can also work a spreadsheet. Because those are the two, at least in my experience, if you have those skills as you walk into the door as a, you know, a new buck insurance adjuster or insurance professional, you're going to find success. And I'm not certain that that's really much different across a whole lot of other commercial institutions.
Yeah, I think I would add certain things to that list. So I think it's important for students to graduate with the ability to come up with a thesis, to state a thesis, to defend a thesis, and to really have a perspective and a point of view, whether that's on a given topic or, you know, a given subject. And I think too often students are dictated by the curriculum of a class or, you know, the classes that they're required to take as part of a major. And so they go through the gauntlet of an undergrad or graduate program without really thinking through and developing the skill set where they can come up with a strong point of view and then defend that point of view. And so I think those are, you know, I think that's a very important skill set. Obviously, you want to be able to defend that point of view with strong written communication, strong verbal communication, strong quantitative skills, so that, you know, would speak to at least some degree your comment around having a spreadsheet and being able to navigate that environment.
Well, and I think that that's one of the values of a college education is beyond the process of stuffing information into your brain. You're sitting in a classroom setting, whether it's a large group or a small group, you're talking, you're having discussions, and you're learning how to think critically. And in a mostly safe environment of the classroom, you can express opinions and learn to listen to what other people are saying.
Definitely.
Anyway, yeah. So, well, as you can tell, this is a conversation that's going to go a lot of different places. I want to go back, and being an Army brat gives you an opportunity to certainly have a wide variety, a diverse educational opportunity. As you're being carted around from military base to military base, were your parents putting you in those typical military schools, or were you getting that public school education?
I got the the public school education. For most of my life, we lived off base. Certainly later in my life, we lived off base. And so elementary school, middle school, high school were all public school education. So I am definitely the outcome of a strong public school education.
So traveling around, being in Europe, did you pick up the foreign language ability?
Later in my life, I lived overseas and picked up. I lived in the Netherlands for 2 years and picked up Dutch while I was there. I studied in the Middle East for a period, and so I picked up a little bit of Arabic while I was there. My freshman year in college, I studied Chinese, so I picked up a little bit there. Dutch, I would say, is the only language that I speak fluently, but I can navigate a market in lots of places in the world.
Well, that's important. You can feed yourself, and you can find out where the bathroom's going to be.
That's right.
That's about all you need. Right. What did you excel at in school before you headed off to college? What were those subjects that you found most interesting and you can point to as being important to you?
I think at the end of the day, hard work. I don't know that any subject came easily to me. It required a lot of hard work, and still does. Anything that I accomplish today is pretty much the product of a lot of hours and a lot of hard work and a lot of editing and re-editing and re-editing again. And so it's just continuing to, push through. Economics was something that made sense to me at an intuitive level, as did finance. And so I continued my formal education in both of those areas. But I also really liked the creative aspects of all of the classes that I took when I was younger. And that creativity played an important role in the type of career that I developed and the type of work that I do today.
Were you a good student?
I would say I was an average student. Certainly through high school, I was very much an average student. When I went to college and then as an undergrad, I definitely tried to apply myself, more and work hard. But at the end of the day, a lot of that came through hard work. So as an undergrad, I graduated with university honors. But that, I think, is indicative of just hard work and dedication and really nothing more.
Where was that undergrad?
So I did my undergrad at Brigham Young University, and then I did my graduate work at George Mason University.
How did you end up at BYU?
Well, so I grew up in the LDS faith, and I did my freshman year at BYU, Hawaii. And then after my freshman year at BYU, Hawaii, I took 2 years off. I served a service mission as a LDS missionary for my church in the Netherlands, and so that's what took me there. And then following that, went to BYU in Provo, Utah, and finished up.
What was the impact of the mission on you in terms of how you looked at your, in terms of returning to college?
So I think a number of things. I mean, certainly I had been living on my own for 2 years, and that adds a level of maturity to your studies. I think at some level I probably felt like I was behind all of my peers who hadn't taken time off from college. And so there was a strong desire to jump back in and catch up from just a pure timing perspective. And so that certainly motivated me. I think there was just a sense of the necessary work that was going to go into that. And again, kind of going back to this theme of hard work. But I really hadn't, during those 2 years, thought much about college. I was very dedicated to the service work that I was doing. I was very focused there. So when I came back to school, I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. And I, like many people, bounced across a number of different majors. I looked at history for a little while. I took art classes. I studied Chinese and ended up at one point being a social work major, which required taking a basic economics class. So many in the class struggled greatly with the topic. And for me, it came very naturally. It's something that resonated with me, felt very intuitive. Economics tends to be a pretty short major. By then, I had amassed a number of credits in all different departments across the university, and so I switched to economics at that point.
Did you have a plan returning from mission? for those last 3 years of college?
I returned, and my first semester was at BYU. I actually then did a study abroad program in Jerusalem, and I was living in East Jerusalem right by Hebrew University. So I studied there, and while I was there, I took classes like Arabic, Middle East, political structures, Middle East society, history classes, and so kind of took a variety of different courses. I had been doing ROTC while I was at BYU, so there was part of me that thought about going into the military at least for some time. And
I was going to ask, did dad have an impact on making a decision one way or the other what you would do post?
After the undergrad? Not at all. I mean, my father is not LDS, and he's since passed away, but he was not actively religious in any religion. And so I think he was naturally apprehensive of me taking time off of college. He felt like there were other ways I could see the world and do things. And so, and given the importance of formal education, didn't like seeing me put my formal education on hold for 2 years while I did that. But it was something that was important to me. And so he supported that somewhat begrudgingly, but supported that. So I think he was just anxious for me to get back into school. And but never really had a strong preference of what I did or what direction to go in.
You finally finished the undergrad. What was that in?
So I got an undergraduate in economics.
Okay. And was there an immediate game plan after that?
No, there was not. I had interned prior to my senior year with Arthur Anderson, which is no longer around, but at the time was a major accounting firm and consulting firm. And I had been doing consulting for them in Silicon Valley. And this is, during the dot-com era. So it was a bustling Silicon Valley at the time, very active, tons of energy, and very exciting place to be. And so I did that. I got an offer to go back after my senior year, to go back after I graduated, but it wasn't something that felt right. And in many of those instances, when you come across that fork in the road, you have to go with your gut a little bit. And so opted not to take the offer, go back to Silicon Valley. Instead, came to Washington, D.C., where my family was living at the time. My parents were living at the time. And I got a job working in the Department of Justice in their antitrust practice. And that ended up being a great opportunity for me. It paid a lot less. It paid about half of what the offer had been with Arthur Anderson. But it was a great opportunity to learn, kind of learn about business, learn about market structure. I had the opportunity to work with some very smart individuals who had tremendous education pedigrees. At the time, I started taking classes in the graduate program at George Mason, still really uncertain of what I wanted to do. As you'll recall, I had a brother who had an MBA and another brother who had a PhD and was teaching linguistics. And so they showed me kind of two very drastically different paths forward. So I started taking economic classes in the graduate program there at George Mason. At the same time, I was working on the CFA designation, the Chartered Financial Analyst designation, and passing those tests, which at the time were offered once a year. And then before I knew it, I had finished all of the coursework required for the PhD and had passed the required exams. And then the only thing left, and I kind of put that in soft quotes because it was still a very big thing, but was my, was my dissertation. And
So you have your master's a couple of years after you get your undergrad, but you kind of have this master's plus and you're almost ABD.
Correct. So I finished a master's in economics, which is essentially the coursework that leads up to a PhD. 2 years after graduating, I just took two classes a semester part-time. So I would work during the day, and then at night I would go to class. And very quickly, I became ABD. By then, I'm having kids, and young kids are keeping me very busy. And so I just didn't think much about the dissertation. In most cases, you have a time limit in which to finish the dissertation, typically 10 years from the time you start the program. So you have 5 years to advance to candidacy, which means you have a topic that's been approved, and then you have 5 years to finish your dissertation. So I started to get letters that said I had, you know, about a year left to advance to candidacy or
Well, at least they sent you a countdown.
They do. They send you a countdown. And so I actually got an extension on that piece on advancing to candidacy because I was late on getting to candidacy. So they while they didn't extend the 10-year period, they did shift it just a little bit. So I eventually put together a dissertation topic, had it approved by my committee, and then from there didn't work as quickly as I should have. And again, at this point, I'm in a new job. I'm developing my career there. I'm coaching baseball teams and basketball teams and trying to be an effective father. And then I start to get letters that say, you know, it's time to write your dissertation and finish your dissertation. You have so much left. And so I took that letter and I hung that above my desk. So that was my motivation to get serious about it and to finish it. And I felt like it would be a waste to not finish it. Now, in economics, we teach to ignore sunk costs. And so I really should have recognized that all the courses and work I'd put in were sunk costs and not to factor that in. But I think did factor that in and really wanted to finish. And so I pushed forward through that process.
You worked at the Department of Justice. Where did you do after you left the DOJ?
So the Department of Justice, I was in what's called a term position. So it essentially is a position that cannot exceed 4 years. So I was there just under 4 years. And then I moved over to the Consumer Technology Association. It was at the time called the Consumer Electronics Association. So it's the trade association that represents about 2,000 technology companies from component manufacturers like Intel and AMD to the manufacturers like Apple, HP, and Samsung, Sony, LG, companies like that, all the way down to service providers like Best Buy and Target and others. And they at the time did not have an economist on staff, so I entered into discussions with them. I'd seen a job posting that they were hiring an analyst and happened to come across them because they showed up on a list of the top 50 places to work in Washington, D.C. So as I explored that and as they saw my background, they created an economist position that I then entered. And at the time, my thought was maybe I'll work here a couple of years and then shift to Wall Street. I had been very attracted to being a Wall Street analyst at the time, to being an equity analyst. I had finished the CFA designation, which is a pretty strong credential in that circle. But at the time, the job offers that I had got to work on Wall Street just didn't feel quite right. This is about 2005. And, I look back and I'm always very grateful that I didn't take the Wall Street jobs at that point, because it would only be another couple of years before those companies cut back significantly and the markets went through the Great Recession. So,
but out of the out of working for CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, CTA now, you got to spend most of your Januarys in Las Vegas,
right? I did,
right?
Yeah. So CTA,
The Consumer Electronics Show.
That's right. CTA is probably best known as the owners and producers of CES, which is, you know, as you noted, used to be called the Consumer Electronics Show. It's the biggest tech event in the world. Takes place the second week of January every year. Las Vegas is the only city big enough to hold it between hotel rooms and convention space. And so I got to go there. And, you know, over top, it is a lot of fun. It's a wonderful place.
I got, yeah, in a previous life, I tried to escape insurance and worked in the custom home theater industry for a short period of time and got to enjoy CES.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see all of the innovation showing up in one place. And there's always new things showing up there. And it's really become a very powerful platform for launching new ideas and new products, not even solely and exclusively within consumer electronics, which is its roots. But you see today driverless cars, you see a variety of different things. This year, Carnival Cruise Lines had launched some of their innovation and technology at the event. So you really see things across the full spectrum of innovation. It's a great place to be.
What were you able to take from your time at CTA, then Consumer Electronics Association? How did you apply what you were doing there and put it into your dissertation?
I don't know that much of what I was doing in my day job applied to my dissertation. What I saw was that I was looking at big questions. I think what I've always really been interested in is looking at big questions and trying to figure out what's driving people to do things or what's driving companies to do things in a certain way. At the time that I was working on my dissertation, Google had released data around their Google Trends project, which was collective search data. And it essentially indexed search queries. So you could look at the popularity of search queries. And at the time, researchers were exploring whether this information was a good predictor of what was happening in the real world. CTA has for decades captured from manufacturers what they're actually shipping in the real world. So one of the essays I wrote for my dissertation looks at the predictive power of a variety of different sentiment indicators and how well they predict TV sales and TV shipments. I took a look at what Google search terms would do and whether they were a good predictor for that. And then I looked at some other indices that I had built looking at consumer sentiment and consumer response to questions.
The dissertation is Sentiment on the Predictive Power of Search, Uncertainty Through the Business Cycle, and Abnormal Stock Returns. Is this essentially a dissertation that's made up of three different papers?
It is, yeah. So there's essentially three separate essays tied loosely around a common theme. This is a trend that you see more today, where they're driving towards multiple essays as opposed to one single book. I think in areas like history, you still seem to see the single book approach. But in other fields, especially economics and business, you're seeing a drive towards multiple essays. And that also then helps after a successful defense when you land somewhere in a tenured track position and you've got to then start working on publications, your dissertation is closer to being able to submit those different papers for publication and then help drive you towards achieving tenure as you work in that direction. So I think it's a good move in academia generally, one, because it helps on that track. And then also the research I have seen suggests that it actually shortens the amount of time that people spend in that dissertation phase.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about what it was that you did for CTA. You said you mostly were focused on big questions within the consumer electronics industry. How did your work then moving towards your dissertation and then even afterwards, how did that help drive your work that you did at the Consumer Electronics Association, or CTA?
So, a lot of what I was doing there was coming up with forecasts and estimates for different variables. And then, of course, over a 12-year career there, your job evolves over time. So I ended up increasingly becoming more of a tech evangelist in addition to the economic work and forecasting work that I was doing. About the same time, I published a book called Digital Destiny. That was published in January of 2015 and ended up being a New York Times bestseller. And then kind of following on that over those last 2 years while I was at CTA, spent a lot of time talking about where the future was going and the things to look at in tech and where the tech industry would start to move towards. So I spent a lot of time doing broad macro forecasting, trend casting, and looking at the way that the industry was moving, looking at the broad sensorization of consumer tech, how that was changing the way that we communicated, the way we work, the way we interact, the type of activities we engage in, how we use these devices, the role that these devices can play at all, and started to spend a lot of time looking at that. And that's where a lot of my work is today, is looking at how technology is changing and how that in turn is changing us as individuals.
Let's talk a little bit about the technology and because you're not coming at this from an engineering or a design background. You're coming at this studying the economics of technology.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I'm looking at not only the economics of technology, but also the behavior of individuals. Where I sit is actually at this very unique intersection between technology, culture, and economics.
As an economist, when you see what's happening in innovation and technology, are we oftentimes stifled, or are real opportunities missed when the money guys want to have too much say in where they're given the money? Does that make sense?
Bringing a new idea to market is not a simple task. And there are a plethora of things that have to happen. One is certainly getting the financial support necessary to bring the product to market or the service to market in a way that it can then garner enough attention to get to a point of critical mass. And so financing plays an important role. Awareness plays an important role. The desire for that service or device plays an important role. So even if consumers or businesses know about it, if they don't see the necessity of it, then it's going to be hard to drive adoption. And we have seen this throughout the last 50 years of innovation, that products come together, they're great products, they're great services, and for whatever reason, they just don't reach the critical mass necessary in order to continue on as a viable service or a viable entity. And then somebody else will come do a very similar thing a few years later, and it will go on and see mass adoption, wide success. And some of that is just getting the right pieces in place. So I like to say that technology moves very slowly until suddenly it doesn't. And we've got a long history of this. The first digital computer arrived in 1942, but it really wasn't until the 80s and 90s, and even really later than that, that home computing became ubiquitous. The first hard drive showed up in 1956, but at that time it's about the size of your refrigerator. Even as late as 2000 in the United States, only about 40% of households have a home computer. Today, it's about 90% of households. So all of that growth has really happened in the last 15 years or so. And you see that today with other things, services, hardware, needing a number of influences and a number of forces to help drive broad awareness and then ultimately mass adoption of the innovation.
Where do you fit in then into this process?
So there's a number of things that we do at Astra Insights. One is certainly looking at the market dynamics and market size and helping companies position their product for going to market and helping them develop that go-to-market strategy. There's another element as well. So we talk about this broad digitization that has taken place, but if you look around, you'll see that we still, for the most part, live in a very analog world. And there's still massive transformation that's going to take place. So yes, much of the music industry has been digitized. Airline ticketing has been digitized. Some share of retail has been digitized. But there's still a tremendous amount of transformation that's yet to take place. I would argue that we have only just scratched the surface of the change that lies before us. Today, businesses are, for the most part, not prepared for the digital transformation that lays before them. They don't understand the tenets of digitization. They don't understand the properties and characteristics of digitization. And so they don't fully grasp how these changes will impact them. They're so focused on their industry that they don't step back and look at the common properties of a digital transformation and then ultimately how that will flow through their be a part of this bigger economy.
Are you talking about that from both the manufacturer and the retailer side?
I would argue that digitization will fundamentally impact everyone, every business, every sector, every individual. A book that I'm working on right now looks at how it's reformatting society, how it's changing the social fabric and the social norms that we have abided by for decades. And I would argue that some of the friction that we see today in society is driven by the impact of digitization, though we don't always assign that to digitization, to this transformation that's taking place throughout society and again, throughout every single business, on the retail side, on the manufacturer side, on the service side. So you look at something like airline tickets, and I'll use that again as an example, that digitized pretty quickly. And we saw that move online. There's a number of reasons why it did digitize quickly. And today, the vast majority of airline tickets are bought through digital platforms, digital mechanisms. Going back to your insurance example, that today is still a very analog business.
Yep.
But that's changing. And there's tremendous opportunity there and tremendous innovation that's gonna play out. So grab a very simple example. If you look at what Uber and Lyft and other services like that have done, they've taken an individual who might have had an insurance policy as a consumer based upon the number of miles driven and based upon other characteristics that were deemed to be explanatory of their use case and the probability ultimately of them getting in accidents or needing to file claims. Now you take that individual and you put them in a position of not just being the consumer of that car service that, you know, that they own, but also being the producer of a car service for other individuals. And so one would argue that their risk profile changes, but it doesn't change in a continuous way. It only changes when they move from consumer as a normal, regular individual to producer, when they become that Lyft driver. And so as a result, the insurance policy that they might want will look drastically different than what they have today. They aren't always a regular household, a regular consumer, 365 days of the year. They're also not a producer 365 days a year. So they may not want an insurance policy that they might buy if they were, say, a taxi company or, you know, full-time driver where they have a certain type of policy. So the ability to toggle on and off these policies and move between them becomes a very interesting and, I would argue, compelling opportunity both for that individual as well as for insurance companies. And digitization enables that transaction to take place. So you can imagine that every time I turn on my Uber app or my Lyft app to become a driver, that insurance policy also clicks on. And so I am only then charged a premium based upon my use of that policy. And so we move to an environment of variable pricing or something like that. Now, where we ultimately end up remains to be seen, but there are lots of companies now that are exploring that type of model. I would argue that one of the tenets of digitization is that we move from discrete time periods to continuous time periods. We go from measuring things at a set period to measuring things in continuous time. And continuous time facilitates this shift to something like variable pricing. And so I would argue that all of this, this whole transformation, is driven by digitization and the characteristics and attributes that are inherent in digitization. And so that's just one simple example of how it might impact the insurance industry. That same idea, that concept, will play out across every industry. And I think you're going to see it impact every segment of the economy. You know, we talk a lot about, for example, the quantified self, measuring our fitness levels with wearables, measuring our activity levels, measuring heart rate and other health-related metrics and fitness-related metrics using wearable devices. The flip side of that is what I call the quantified worker. So this is an employee who has these same wearables. And now what can I ascertain about the quality of work that they're producing? What can I ascertain about how they might be using equipment? Is there a more efficient way that they might be using equipment? Is there safer ways that they could be using equipment such that I benefit from that, they benefit from that? And so we have yet to really move into that space at all. We're starting to look at it. Companies are starting to explore what it might mean. But there's a tremendous number of technologies that have started to move into the masses that I would argue are going to fundamentally shift how business is done.
From a life safety health position, it certainly would have an impact on a company's bottom line for workers' compensation insurance, and maybe even when you're taking a look at protecting the physical assets.
Definitely. Yep.
Buildings, et cetera.
It will touch everything. I mean, another example from insurance to continue along that theme, companies today are pretty good at buying insurance for traditional equipment, so your PP&E on a corporate balance sheet. But increasingly, corporate balance sheets are made up of intangible assets. These are digital services, digital goods, brand. And I would argue that insurance hasn't kept up. Some of the stats that I've seen suggest that across the U.S., the average company has about 80% of their PP&E insured, but only about 15% of their intangible digital assets or things like that, brands, insured. And so there's a mismatch there between where the asset value is and the insurance. I would argue digitization can facilitate those transactions and facilitate aligning risk mitigation with where the asset value lies. And so all of these things will be fundamentally transformed. Drones are going to start to change the way we do business across a number of different segments. Augmented reality, virtual reality are going to change how we do business in a variety of different segments. What we know is that it typically takes about 7 years to unleash the full productivity enhancing capabilities of a new innovation or of a new technology. And so you think about where we are in that cycle, we're still very, very new. I mean, the iPhone's only been around for 10 years. Smartphones have only been around a little bit longer than that. It's only now that we're really starting to unleash the productivity enhancing capabilities of these devices. And I think that will play out for all of these other technologies that have been released in the last 10 years.
On the other side of that, we've seen, you're talking about the digitization of so much of our lives. Then we have the people that want to do bad things with all that digitization. And at some point, when do we as a society have to make a decision as to who's responsible for protecting all this digitized information? I go to the Experian, and maybe it's not a specific question that you can answer, but from an economist's point of view, at some point, how do we measure the impact of when bad people are trying to take advantage of this system, and what's the ability to protect ourselves from an economic standpoint? Where's that balance?
Economists use the concept of externalities to suggest that there are these effects that happen as a result of something else happening. When I look at digitization, I would argue that there's a tremendous number of externalities, some of them positive and some of them negative. And we often don't recognize the externalities at first. It takes some time of a new technology being around, new innovation being around, before we start to recognize the externalities. What I've seen as I've studied technology and looked at the history of technology over the last 50 years is that you'll introduce some innovation to address some problem, you'll derive a solution, but then you'll also have these externalities. The positive ones you ignore because those are benefits that accrue, and then you then take a look at the negative ones, which become new problems and require new solutions. So technology then again steps in, innovation is employed to solve some of these newfound problems. As a result, then again, we end up with a solution, but also some additional problems which we didn't foresee. And so then we apply a new technology. I think that's one of the real risks around tight regulation of new products, because we don't know in the end what the use case scenarios are going to look like. We don't know exactly how we'll unleash the new innovations. Take a look at something as simple as the mobile phone. Look at the number of services that have been born as a result of the presence of the mobile phone. We mentioned Lyft and Uber already. Banking, financial transactions, mobile payments, retailing.
Oh, the gaming industry. I mean, just any number. You take a look at gaming.
Right.
How many jobs have been created because people are playing Candy Crush or whatever job, you know, whatever game they want to play that way, or Facebook and Twitter, et cetera. So, you know, 10 years ago, Steve Jobs stands on a stage and it's the birth of an entire new industry that is significantly impactful on us today.
Correct. And if you look back at when Steve Jobs stood on that stage and introduced the original iPhone, he totally missed some of the things that that phone would ultimately, in the end, end up doing, and one of the most important areas in which it would do things. So he talked about it being three products in one, and it was essentially taking existing products and putting them into a single product. In that, he does not include photography. He doesn't include cameras.
Right.
It did, you know, have and eventually become an important camera. And today, you look at that, and it the role that photography plays is tremendous. Now you're seeing iPhone ship with multiple image sensors on the same side of the device, so you can start to do depth of field. That's having an impact on interior design. That's having an impact on, you know, furniture manufacturers and retailers and impacting them. And all of that is simply because we've now digitized new elements that we weren't digitizing 10 years ago. And now we're putting that in the hands of everyday consumers and everyday businesses.
On your website, New York Times bestselling author, futurist, and trendcaster. I'll put you here on the spot, but we've got the Christmas season coming up. iPhone X releases here in a couple of weeks. What have you seen the last couple of months that is going to be driving the Christmas season, you think?
So there's so much on the horizon. If you look at what's happening with the consumer, there's obviously tremendous forces at play there, from smartphones to virtual reality. In televisions, you're seeing a little bit of a renaissance because you've got 4K prices coming down and adoption going up. And so consumers are starting to drive into 4K. And so you've got tremendous number of things that will drive things on the consumer front. Wearables continue to expand. The smartwatch category is holding in there. Smart home is doing phenomenally well, especially driven by some of these digital assistants from Amazon, Google, and others. And so I think there's still a tremendous amount of room that those can go. And if you look on the enterprise side, there's some fascinating things happening. We don't hear much about it, but this idea of software robots. So essentially, think about software that can help automate everyday tasks that you're doing in the workplace, I think will play a very big role over the next 36 months. And these, by the way, are programs that are trained by the end user. So you don't have to have coding experience. You don't have to have a deep IT background or be well-credentialed in the IT space. The software learns what it needs to do by watching you do it and seeing what you do over and over again, and then it can start to do those type of things on your behalf, whether that's data entry into a spreadsheet or something else. And so I think that has a tremendous opportunity to unleash incredible productivity on the enterprise side. And we're only just now scratching the surface there. And so I think in the short term, there's a lot of innovation that's coming. As we look further out, I think you'll see even more develop. You know, as I mentioned earlier, we're still very much in an analog world. And every time we digitize a new element, it creates a whole new dynamic. And then that spills into all of the adjacent spaces and all the adjacent fields.
I got to tell you, though, I love my vinyl.
Well, you've seen a renaissance happen there as well. So there are these interesting frictions that exist and these interesting storylines that play out. We've seen a renaissance in record players. And you've seen a renaissance today in analog cameras, especially among millennials. So they are going back to film. I joke that they want the original Instagram filter of shooting with analog film. This is a technology that many of that group, that age cohort, has never used. I was talking with a retailer in the specialty photography space. They told me they had somebody come in to buy an analog camera. they asked the sales associate to show them how to load the film. The sales associate was a millennial and didn't know how to load the film. They'd never loaded a canister of film into a camera. So, and that has massive spillover as well. As we see this renaissance in analog cameras, there's also a corresponding renaissance in film development. You can't get your film developed at your local drugstore like you used to. You used to be able to go into a Walgreens or a CVS.
That's all gone away, and so that's all
consolidated at these specialty retailers that are still focused on photography and camera equipment, camera supplies, and so they're seeing tremendous growth there. I've talked to some that see film canisters being shipped to them from around the globe, certainly from around the country. Some of them are doing as many as 100 a day. And so you've had a renaissance happen there. And so those are the things that fascinate me, that where we see digitization change society and change culture and change the way we do business. And then ultimately we see other adjustments take place. I'm sure you've seen that a number of Navy ships have crashed into each other in different instances, primarily in Asia. We've had a number of unfortunate accidents there. And so I've seen recent reports that the Navy is going back to analog ways of navigation, going back and relearning some of these analog tools.
That was a really interesting story on NPR a couple of weeks ago that talked about the changes of training and how the Navy and the military had gone to this idea that you can move kids out of the classroom and essentially on the job train them while they're, expect them to learn while they're in their bunk, and not on the bridge or whatever. So, yeah, that it is interesting piece. I want to ask you, 20 years ago, were you a tech and gadget guy?
No, I wasn't. I developed that interest after spending 12 years with the Consumer Technology Association. And again, for me, I'm most fascinated with how it changes us as individuals, how it changes businesses. And that's where I really spend my focus. Digitization is the driving force today with change. So had I been studying business dynamics and business change 20, 30 years ago, I would have been looking at other forces. Today, it is primarily driven by, and in some areas exclusively driven by, what's happening in technology and digitization broadly.
Would 18-year-old Sean be happy with where you're at today?
I think so. I mean, I think that 18-year-old Sean probably wouldn't recognize me. He probably wouldn't feel like I was counterculture enough for him. But I think so. I don't know. That's a great question to consider. I think.
Were you a long-haired kid listening to a lot of alternative music?
I was. Yeah. I mean, I had long hair. I grew up listening to straight edge punk, and was very into music that had a cause, and I was, like many 18-year-olds, very into to causes. And so it's a good reflection to think about.
Sean, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate talking about your journey as you went through your PhD.
Yeah, great to be here.
Sean Dubrovic, thank you very much for your time and talking with me about your PhD journey. Certainly enjoyed it. The music in the background is Smokey Joe's La La by Googie Renee. That's off of the Baby Driver soundtrack. It is now my second favorite music soundtrack. Okay, not counting Lord of the Rings or any of those, but Gross Point Blank, and it did replace the soundtrack to The Departed. But I digress. We're not talking about PhD stuff here. Hope you enjoyed our time here today. Look forward to finding some more PhDs out there to talk with. Hey, by the way, I'm going to be in New York City for almost a week in early December.
Do you know any PhDs that I might be able to talk to? Shoot me a note or DM me via the Twitter if you have any ideas. I've got some of my own coming up, but we'll see what I can get. And if you know anybody, please tell me about them. Thanks for hanging out and listening to another journey as we piled it high and deep, the podcast. Have a great day.